Welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today, as we are here every time we podcast, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And today, my guest is my dear good friend, Deacon Stephen Greidonis. How you doing, Steve?
I'm good. I just got back from retreat. It was my first retreat since my canonical retreat before I was ordained. And so I'm feeling very rested and very spiritual. How about you?
Okay. I am tanned and rested and ready to go. Yes, sirree, Bob. In fact, I took a lovely nap today, which is not something I get to do as often as I would like. So I am, yes, the brain is functional. And I am moving forward, ever forward. What's going on? What's happening?
Nothing much. I'm just here to talk about Star Trek and religion and chew bubble gum. And I've just run out of bubble gum.
All right.
So let's do it.
Okay. Don't get gum on the mic. So Star Trek and religion, because Gene Roddenberry was such an intensely deeply religious man.
So Gene Roddenberry's relationship with religion and Star Trek's relationship with religion are obviously very closely related topics, but they're not identical. And that's one of the things I talk about in my article, What Does a Starship Need with God? This, of course, is my very clever twist on the signature line from Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, in which Captain Kirk utters the immortal, but we sadly wish we could kill it line. What does God need with a starship?
That's right. Star Trek V is, well, the less said, the better.
Yes. But, whether God needs a starship or a starship needs God, people who need God have often found starships and the things connected with science fiction and space fantasy to be helpful in thinking about religion from different perspectives. I want to share a very personal example from my own life in connection with my experience of the Mass. And Star Trek.
Okay, because you're a nerd.
Yeah. Because I'm a nerd, yes. Yes. Okay. I'm a nerd about my religion, and I'm fanatical about my my science fiction enthusiasm. That's that's a twist on a line from Brother Guy, the head astronomer for the Vatican Observatory. He's also a brother, I think. And he did a TED Talk. In which he talked about his MIT ring and his, I don't remember what was whether it was his clerical collar or something, but he said that certified him as he was both a fanatic and a geek. He was a nerd. He was nerdy about his religion and he was fanatical about his science.
He's fun. The guy's name is his brother Guy Consolmagno.
Yes.
So you know, as Italian as it gets too.
Yes.
I can't remember. Is he a Jesuit or like a – no, they don't have brothers, do they?
I honestly can't recall. But
anyway,
when I was a young Protestant struggling to understand Eucharistic theology, something you remember. You and I were corresponding back in those days.
Yeah, I do. I do remember. Yes.
One of the things that I found so striking was the insistence of St. Thomas – and other writers that although they want to insist that Jesus is really and truly present in the Eucharist in the fullness of his being, humanity and divinity, body and soul, there is one way in which he is not present in the Eucharist, and that is he is not present locally or present as in a place. And what this appears to mean is that Jesus' body is spatially located in heaven, which is to say we can't imagine where he is. He's gone beyond the realm of our existence.
Right.
But that when he becomes present in the Eucharist, he does not literally come down out of heaven. Rather, right, that which is in heaven is made present to us on earth.
Mm-hmm.
And when the priest elevates the host, Christ is not elevated in space. If we want to picture him, and it's this metaphor, but we can picture him sitting on his throne at the right hand of the Father, he doesn't move. And he's present in the host. The host moves, and the host is Christ, but Christ doesn't move. And I thought, gosh, this is a little bit like a wormhole, right? Like in Deep Space Nine, you know, you've got this wormhole that brings two ends of space close together, or it could even collapse the space entirely, so that, you know, like the door in the stable in C.S. Lewis's The Last Battle, right? Where mm-hmm. you can reach out and touch another world through this mm-hmm. doorway. And the Eucharist is a little bit like that. And mm-hmm. one end of the wormhole moves, but the other end of the wormhole doesn't. And
some okay.
people, this is very helpful to some people. Other people's eyes are glazing over at this point.
But you might say that the Eucharist is bigger on the inside.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
To vary the nerdly references and metaphors. Go ahead. Well, anyway.
But there is a theme in one particular episode of Star Trek that I have always found for decades very meaningful in my experience of the Mass. And I don't think of this every week at Mass, or maybe even every month, but I think of it often. Mm-hmm. And it's a line from the pilot episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which I know you're a fan of.
Yes. Great show.
Yes. So in this episode, he's commander at this point, Commander Benjamin Sisko, comes to the newly christened Deep Space Nine, which is orbiting around the planet of Bajor, and it's by this wormhole opening. And he encounters these beings in the wormhole, these wormhole entities or wormhole aliens, as we call them, but the Bajorans venerate them as gods. And they reveal themselves to Sisko in this very powerful way. He sees visions of his past life, and the aliens, the wormhole aliens, speak to him from the faces of people that he has known. And it turns out that they're trying to understand Sisko's experience of temporality, of time, of linear time. His life is one moment followed by another in succession. And apparently the wormhole aliens don't have this kind of linear time. They're in some way outside of time because they're outside of space. They live in a wormhole. So that makes them already a little bit godlike. But they continue to confront Sisko with this one particular moment in his life, which is the worst day of his life. It's the day that his wife died, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the reason that they return him again and again to this moment is that they realize that it constitutes an anomaly in Sisko's existence. They say to him, "You exist here. It is not linear." So Sisko has become, in a way, unmoored in linearity because he is anchored to this day that his wife died. He's become stuck. He's become emotionally unable to move forward, and this is not linear. And so there's a little bit of a science fiction conceit around the psychological idea of healing and moving on.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, this phrase has always had a very powerful resonance to what it is that we do in the Eucharistic liturgy.
Okay.
Because the Eucharistic liturgy takes us outside of normal clock time, out of Chronos and into Kairos, into the time of heaven. It is a celebration and a participation in the eternal liturgy, the eternal worship of God that is going on in heaven all the time. And while there's a symbolic dimension to this, there's also a dimension which is not symbolic, which is namely the Eucharist itself, which is a piece of timelessness that is present on our altars. And in it, we are made present to Jesus Christ beyond all bounds of time and space. And the one sacrifice that he offered for us all on the cross 2,000 years ago is not mired in the past 2,000 years ago, but it becomes a present and living reality. And so in the Mass, not infrequently, I say to myself, "You exist here." It is not linear, because it's from the Mass. The Mass, the Catechism tells us, is the source and summit of the Christian life. We live from the Mass. Everything that we do flows from the offering of Jesus, which we receive in the Blessed Sacrament, and everything that we do flows back into the Mass. We bring our lives back to the Mass, and we offer ourselves to God in union with Christ. And so that is my reflection on how Star Trek has enriched my experience of the Mass.
Oh, I like that. That's really great. And yeah, you're right. That timelessness of the Mass, that being taken out of Kronos and into Kairos time, I've not used that line from Deep Space Nine to try to describe it to myself, but something very similar obtains. C.S. Lewis at one point talks about the crucifixion, and by extension the incarnation, as this moment at which something unimaginable breaks into this world. And that's, by the way, that's the language of iconography. One of the things that you'll notice if you look at an icon is very, very frequently the icon is painted so that the figure is in a frame, but his hands or her hands or head are breaking out of the frame. And exactly what's being communicated there is that the figure, the saint or Jesus being portrayed in the icon, is breaking into our world.
That from another space.
From another space and time, yeah, if you will. And so, yeah, it's very much that imagery of heaven kind of smashing into our world. And that's the language that Jesus uses, for example, when he speaks to Peter. When he says that the gates of hell will not prevail against the church, that is military siege language. So for some reason, people have this notion that, you know, we're the church and we're hunkered down in the fortress and the enemy is attacking us with gates.
Right, right.
You don't attack people with gates. You attack people with siege equipment and with swords and so forth, and you're trying to break through the gates. And that's what's happening. And that's what's been happening ever since Christmas morning. The first Christmas morning is the church has been smashing in through the siege works of hell. And this is the earth is enemy occupied territory. Christmas morning in Christian theology, the closest analogy that we have for Christmas morning is D-Day. That was the day that God invaded occupied earth. And so that's what's happening in the Mass. As well, supremely, that's what's happening in the Mass, is we're not just remembering something that happened 2,000 years ago. We are participating in that present action that is still going on right now and being advanced with every Mass. That's what's taking place.
Absolutely.
So, anyway, very
cool.
All
of this, of course, would be utterly inimical to Gene Roddenberry's secular humanist vision, the vision that he tried his best to incorporate in the original Star Trek and in an even more rarefied degree in the first season of The Next Generation before he lost control of the franchise for reasons partly related to the failure of Star Trek The Motion Picture. But a friend of mine on Facebook has said that Gene Roddenberry's ideal for Star Trek is basically a science fiction adaptation of John Lennon's Imagine.
Exactly right. Exactly right. With I remember one writer describing it as a universe, especially in The Next Generation, a universe of leotard-clad United Nations conflict resolution counselors. Going around making sure that there's no conflict, which is, bad drama.
It's very bad drama. And there's a reason why when Roddenberry lost control of the franchise, this vision was significantly modified. Right. Jonathan Frakes did a documentary on the early going in Star Trek The Next Generation in which he basically the picture that comes across is no, it was William Shatner. Shatner's
William Shatner. Yes. It's a documentary called Chaos on the Bridge.
Chaos on the Bridge. It basically arguing that Gene Roddenberry nearly killed Star Trek, and his devotion to his secular humanist ideal of the perfectibility of human nature was part of what almost killed Star Trek. And here's where we have to recognize that while Gene Roddenberry was a true creative visionary, and a great deal of what is great about Star Trek, we owe it to him. But a lot like another great visionary who gave us another huge 20th century science fiction franchise that's still going on, Star Wars, Roddenberry could sometimes be his own worst enemy. Mm-hmm. And as so often happens in the collaborative world of the screen, whether the big screen or the small screen, the best versions of the creative visions of these two men often emerged in what you could call a kind of a fruitful collaboration with other creative minds, sometimes with conflicting visions. So, for instance, many people feel, and I'm among them, that The Empire Strikes Back is the best Star Wars movie.
Yes.
And it was the screenplay and the direction are not by George Lucas, and the creative input of the two men who helped to shepherd Lucas's vision to the screen, they a significant part of the credit for the deepening and the expanding of the Star Wars universe belongs to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and I would argue, I mean, this is really fast forwarding here, but I think the guy who did more to deepen the Star Trek universe and really then leapt beyond that defiantly to against Roddenberry's vision is Ronald Moore, the guy who goes on to create the emphatically religious Battlestar Galactica, the reboot of Battlestar Galactica, which it's not only all about religion, but it's a conflict between polytheists and monotheism, and it's a show that just revels in the Mormon origin. Moore's not a Mormon, but he understood that the guy who created Battlestar Galactica was a Mormon, and based it on Mormon mythology, and he says, "Let's go with that. This is going to be great storytelling." And at its best, the Battlestar Galactica reboot is some of the best science fiction storytelling ever put on television, I think.
So it's certainly there's a lot to be said for it, and it was, you know, as you say, it was very overtly dealing with religious themes, and it ultimately winds up affirming the existence of God and of angels. They're not like our angels, but they're still angels of some sort.
Right.
In the case of Star Trek, I think one of the early blows was struck by a science fiction writer named Theodore Sturgeon, who wrote one of the most popular episodes of all time, the season 2 premiere, called Amok Time.
That's in the original series.
The original series, which significantly complicates what we know of Vulcans. Until now, Vulcans have been the quintessential scientists with their famous logic, and everything is dispassionate. And what Sturgeon suggests is that maybe Vulcan culture has this very complicated and previously unguessed counter element in it. Mm-hmm. Rituals and customs shrouded in antiquity, in a line that he puts on Spock's lips. Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, in connection with Vulcan mating. Kirk says, we would expect Vulcan mating to be done and in accordance with logic. And Spock says, you would be wrong. so what he introduces are a host of elements drawn from human religious culture, ritual, and ceremony, and a certain archaic stylized way of speaking, reflective most directly, I think, in this episode of Amok Time, of the Quakers, who continued to say things like "the R," you know, long after everybody else was just saying "you are."
Right.
So, and this alternate side of the Vulcan culture laid the groundwork for where the franchise went on the big screen in the wake of the catastrophic failure of Star Trek: The Motion Picture, in a series of films which, ironically, Gene Roddenberry hated, the greatest and most popular Star Trek film of all time, one of the great science fiction films of all time, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. He hated it.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, man, that's a great film.
See, this is what I'm saying. He was right. He could be his own worst enemy, and he was not always appreciative of the best version of his own vision.
Huh. Okay.
So, but what this episode does in killing off Spock, but killing him off in the shadow of new life in this Genesis planet, which has sprung into existence with all these creative energies, life-giving energies around them, thus allowing for
the resurrection of Spock.
Right. But in order to make it hard and costly and not just a cheap reversal of the first film, we have to go a very long journey with Spock before he can be himself again. Right. And so this involves this world of Vulcan mysticism and right. ritual. We have to go to Mount Seleia on Vulcan. And what do we find there? We find a full-blown monastery with monks whacking on gongs and maiden attendants in these diaphanous gowns, and a Vulcan high priestess modeled after a character from A Muck Time, who talks in full blown King Jamesese, and this religious ritual that involves trying to transfer Spock's soul, his katra. This is something previously unknown in Star Trek, that when a Vulcan is near death, somehow their soul, everything that is not of the body, can survive by being passed onto someone else and then brought to Mount Seleia, where in some manner it goes on, that there is life after death for Vulcans. All of this, the groundwork for that was laid in that one episode of Muck Time.
Yeah, yeah. And you could see why Roddenberry would hate this. Roughly the same time that that film is being made, there's, I think, the worst episode of Next Generation is made, called "Who Watches the Watchers," which is sort of like this is Roddenberry's like the final death throes. of rebellion, you know, against all of this stuff, right? And so you get this, it's this thing where the crew of the Enterprise gets mistaken by gods by these primitives who live on this planet. And so this gives really Roddenberry a chance to, you know, make his final screw you speech against all religious belief and put it in the mouth of Captain Picard.
Yeah, and the plot of this episode, Who Watches the Watchers, is pretty typical of a theme that Roddenberry revisited over and over in the original series, which is the Enterprise crew goes to a planet and the beings there worship some god, and he has to be unmasked or exposed as being unworthy of worship and adoration. And of course, you could take that either as this is what all gods are, or you could take it as this is what all false gods are.
Right.
But what really pushes Who Watches the Watchers past that is Picard's speech, where he says that these proto-Vulcans have millennia ago, that they rejected superstition and the worship of gods, and now, you know, somebody wants him to plunge them back into a sea of superstition. He basically throws all of religion under the bus in that one line.
Right, right. And so, you know, in the original series, you couldn't get away with that. And there, we know that he had proposed ideas in which literally there was one episode where he wanted to have, Kirk. I think it was like a movie. He pitched a movie idea where Kirk winds up getting in a fist fight with Jesus.
This
creature claiming to be Jesus or something.
This was Roddenberry's idea for what he wanted to do originally with what became Star Trek the Motion Picture, fake god of the week extended episode. He'd wanted to call it Star Trek the God Thing. And it was going to – I'm not – that sounds like a satire, but that was literally – was going to call it the God Thing. And it was going to be the grand summary of all of his anti-religious animus. And we were going to meet a being who was many divinities on many different planets. And it was going to turn out that supposedly this alien is the reality behind Jesus Christ, and therefore Christianity itself is false. And he even has Vulcans. There was a line where Vulcans are critiquing the idea of Earth religion, and they say something like, we Vulcans have never really understood your human myths of God, particularly as so many of your gods have said that you must bow down on your bellies and worship me every 7 days. This seems like they are
so
very
– So many!
You can just – the list goes on and on.
Well, there's God, and there's God, and let's not forget Adonai, and yeah.
To us, like, they are very insecure gods. So Paramount was like, yeah, we're not doing that.
You think? Yeah, that's pretty great. But really, a title like The God Thing, I mean, that kind of summarizes – that's kind of Roddenberry's whole fictional life, you know, particularly as time goes on, because it gets more and more obsessive for him. And I think you're right, to the great harm of the franchise, you know. What you see, especially once Roddenberry dies, is the writers are really – they feel themselves liberated. and so you get – well, you get things like Deep Space Nine.
It begins in Next Gen with the introduction of a character called Ensign Ro, who's the first Bajoran that we meet. And she's kind of lapsed in her belief. I think she's pretty clearly a sort of lapsed Catholic type.
Right.
But she lays the groundwork when we go to Bajor and
Lapse Israeli, because the Bajorans are Israelis. In that universe. I mean, you know, you've got the Bajorans are clearly Israelis, and the Kardashians are clearly Nazi Kardashians. Cardassians are
that would be a totally different conversation.
I wonder where they got that word from. It does make me wonder if they just said, you know, Kardashian, let's just use that. That's kind of a long sounding, weird sounding name. We'll just call them Cardassians instead. But clearly, you know, so much of that dynamic between Cardassians and Bajorans is it can be a stand in for any oppressed people, but this is, you know, Nazis and angry Israeli former terrorists who fought, you know, to liberate themselves and so on.
There's certainly a lot of that going on in Deep Space Nine. And Deep Space Nine gives us our first major positive character of faith, Major Kira Nerys.
Yes. She,
and her belief is somewhat complicated and it evolves over time, but she's not like Ensign Ro. She's not lapsed in her belief.
Right. Yes.
And the show, although it really deals with a number of different religious points of view, it's not just the Bajoran religion. We also get the religion of the founders, and the beings like Wei Yun, who worship the founders, who are the beings like Odo. Mm-hmm. And there's some Klingon religion in there once once Worf joins the crew in season four.
And this
openness to different religious themes, and not, you know, so we don't share the religious beliefs of Wei Yun or of any of the other characters, but there is a certain openness to religion as an ennobling force in their life, and the possibility of interpreting the wormhole aliens in more than one way, and maybe even the founders. Mm-hmm. And then in later episodes, series in Voyager and Enterprise, you know, this openness to religious ideas goes on. I was never a fan of Enterprise myself, but I seem to recall someone telling me that at one point Archer says something like, I'm open-minded, I'm interested in all religions, mm-hmm. which is not something one can imagine, you know, Captain Picard saying.
Right. Yeah. You get a little, well, you get very much the kind of the American civil religion. That's kind of what Kirk represents.
Sure.
You know, so at one point he tells the Greek god and who mourns for Adonais, we find the one god quite sufficient.
Right. And, you know, and whether this is some, and Roddenberry co-wrote that episode, it might have been a piety that was kind of imposed on him.
That's what it feels like to me.
And there are other things that are like that. There's a scene in, it turns out that there's an ecumenical chapel on the original Enterprise in the original series. And there's a number of scenes that are set there. I think at one point, Kirk performs a wedding in this ecumenical chapel, and he makes a reference to our many faiths.
Right. Yeah.
So, and this is
yeah, really, and the most famous, you know, example of this, which I'm sure was imposed on Roddenberry's Bread and Circuses, where Roddenberry likes he loves the what if history repeated itself on another planet,
right,
idea. You know, mm-hmm. So we get that repeatedly, sometimes to great comic effect, as in a piece of the action where you've got the Chicago 1925 planet. And then there's Bread and Circuses, where we're transported to ancient Rome. And we find out at the climax of the story that the slaves who have been speaking of the worship of the sun don't mean the sun in the sky. They mean the Son of God.
Isn't it great when English puns work in an ancient Roman culture on another planet?
It's so fortunate that they all spoke English instead of Latin. that was really kind of the climax of that. I don't know what you'd call it, you know, the robification of Star Trek, you know, where you get to have they did everything but have the soaring angelic choir at the end. But that's, you know, that's a story that I think was very obviously, Roddenberry approved that through gritted teeth. That's not a story that Roddenberry would ever have written himself.
Probably. Although you could always make the argument, and Roddenberry might have rationalized it to himself this way, that the episode doesn't assert that this Son of God really is divine.
Right.
Because we have this world where there has been another Christ, yes, but also another Caesar.
Right.
And, you know, there's the Romans believed in the divinity of Caesar, and the Christians believed in the divinity of Christ. And Roddenberry could believe that they were both repeated on another planet without believing either of their claims of divinity.
Well, okay, all right, I can buy that. But what you see as time goes on, I remember reading an article one time that kind of described Roddenberry's progress, you know, as a creative thinker. It says, you know, once upon a time there was a guy who made cop shows, who conceived of a science fiction show as Wagon Train to the Stars, and thought, well, I'll pitch this to a network and see if I can sell it. And sure enough, it sold. And so they made some episodes, and You know, but then he started to read his own press releases and became convinced that he was indeed a deep thinker. And then he stopped thinking of Star Trek as here's a chance for, you know, Kirk to, you know, put the squeeze on some hot babe this week and then fight a monster, and started thinking to himself, this is philosophy. This is serious, you know. And as that goes on, then, you know, you start getting to things like the God thing. And,
well, I do want to give Roddenberry his due. I don't think that he came to Star Trek with the idea of doing something, profound or philosophical, but I do think that he did have serious ideas, and he had he had a vision that he intended to put forward really from the beginning. And it was a utopian vision. It was a vision of mankind improving from where we were, not just technologically, but in other ways as well. Not necessarily perfected, but you know, the fact that you had on the bridge of the Enterprise right from the beginning, you know, you have
a multicultural crew.
You've got you've got the white male captain, and right off to one side, you've got this black woman who is, you know, she's one of the professionals on this bridge.
Right.
You've got in season two, I think we introduce a Russian ensign, and got a Chinese pilot, and in the 1960s, that was
a big deal.
It was a big deal.
Well, and in fact, Nichelle Nichols was begged by Martin Luther King.
Yes.
To stay in the role. She was thinking about moving on, and he said, "You can't. You can't leave that role."
Right.
And she said, "Why?" He said, "Because," he said, "You're one of the greatest role models in the United States for black people in the United States. There are no other places where black people were shown in command positions anywhere on TV."
Right.
And so that had not dawned. You know, she was thinking in terms of her career, and he was thinking in terms of, you know, what models are available. Well, there weren't any. That was a big deal. And so, yes, I think you're right. Roddenberry has to be given credit for that. He did, you know, he was trying. You can hear in the very language of the introduction to the show, this is somebody who took Kennedy's New Frontier language very seriously, you know, and really believed that we could be better than we were. And that's not a bad thing. You know?
It's not. And, you know, I have to say that there's something a little discouraging. Even Brad Bird's Tomorrowland really lamented this point without doing to fix it. But we live in an age in which I think we're starved for idealism.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to look any further than the DC Extended Universe. Superman himself is
this Nietzschean nihilist.
He's this glum, hopeless, passive, directionless. You know, everybody talks. I want to pull up my hair every single time I hear the trailer for the new Justice League movie. In every DC movie so far, somebody has some line about what an inspiring figure Superman is and how he shows humanity a better way. And he doesn't do anything of the kind. They know what Superman is supposed to be, but they can't get there. And, you know, the rebooted Star Trek movies, I have to say, you know, Star Trek Into Darkness, and then the latest one, Star Trek Beyond, at their best, they can be fun. But I don't think anybody would look at – there's not a whole lot there that you would call aspirational or inspiring.
Right.
We seem to have lost – And it was never, you know, a huge part of pop culture, but Gene Roddenberry offered us the idea of a shiny, hopeful vision of the future, of a future that was worth striving for. And if sometimes he was a little too naive and a little too utopian, hey, there are worse things in the world than, you know, an overly hopeful ideal to strive for.
Right. And, you know, it's one of the things really, I think, beginning with Enterprise. Enterprise is a post 9/11 vision of the future where you've got, you know, the captain of the Enterprise not only thinking about but actually committing acts of torture. Kirk, you know, say what you will about Kirk. Kirk would never torture somebody. That's just not – he'll slug them, you know. Picard wouldn't even do that. Picard would, you know, would agonize and then eventually do the right thing. But when they made that turn, this is one of the reasons – I haven't seen Discovery yet, but I sort of dread it because I'm afraid that what I'm going to get is more of the Enterprise version of the Star Trek franchise, which really irked me. That was a Enterprise was a show that deserved to die. And I didn't feel bad at all when it got canceled because it was like, no, we're losing system integrity here.
Well, maybe. I've only seen the first two episodes myself so far. And I was interested in looking to see what they had to say about what openness they would have to religious themes. And so far. Okay. Seems to be primarily Klingon religion that we're looking at, and there's an interesting diversity among the Klingons. There are the fanatics, and then there are those who kind of look at, you know, Kalis, the Klingon messiah figure, as a fable. And you know, there are interesting things that you can do there, connecting these, you know, the fanatical Klingons to radical Muslims. Or far right American nationalists, and I think that both of those are probably factors in the storyteller's minds. But there is a darker side to the Star Trek universe that goes back at least as far as Deep Space Nine. I don't want to give anything away, and I don't really know anything yet. But there's a theory out there that we could be looking at the origins of something significant that we know about the Star Trek universe and about something dark, a darker element in the Federation, going back to Deep Space Nine. If the characters in Discovery seem to be not quite up to Star Trek idealism, that could be part of the reason why.
Okay. That brings us to a point that I just want to touch on briefly, and then we're going to have to go. But one of the things, and this is a constant that I run into over and over and over again in science fiction and fantasy. We've discussed this in the past, and I really think that it's probably worth exploring it at some length at some time. But it's this. My son and I formulated it very simply as this. Archaeology is evil. This is a theme that shows up over and over again in science fiction and fantasy and in the Star Trek universe. And the message that we get from, you know, Indiana Jones or The Mummy or Stargate or Babylon 5 or the Star Trek universe as well is if you dig into the past, you will always uncover some eldritch horror. Some monstrous thing, you know, and the message that comes through over and over again, and I think that it's significant, is the past is evil. Don't look back. If you look back, you will always find something awful. So the only place to go is forward. You must always look to the future because the past is that period in which unspeakable evil dwells. And I think that that's interesting. That theme comes up over and over again in science fiction and fantasy. I'm just throwing it out here. Perhaps we can make it a conversation.
I'd like to talk about that. There is a side of Star Trek that is literate and that appreciates the heritage of Western civilization and of other cultures beyond that. And I think that might provide something of a countervailing theme. I'd also like to talk about how Star Trek reversed another theme that was very common in the pop culture prior to Star Trek, which is the idea that science is always evil.
Right, yeah.
There are no admirable scientist characters that I can think of in major Hollywood movies or major television productions. I'm not saying there aren't any, but I can't think of any prior to Mr. Spock. He's the first.
Okay, that's interesting.
Scientists before that are, if they're not evil, they're at least weird and not someone that you would ever look up to and admire. And many people have been inspired to appear in science because of Mr. Spock.
I don't know if I'd go that far, because very often, there is, when the great monster emerges out of wherever, sure, usually that monster is there because we just set off a bomb, or we polluted a river, or, did something like that. There's a great moment in a film called The Beginning of the End with Peter Graves, who is doing some experiment where he's like dosing plants with some kind of radioactive chemical to make them grow much faster, which winds up creating this race of gigantic grasshoppers who go. And at one point he's looking at it. And I was watching an MST3K version of this movie. I remember watching the original movie when I was a kid. And he's looking at these plants that he's made radioactive and stuff, and realizes the connection between the plants that he's been working on and these giant insects. And he's talking to the heroine, and he says, "In a way, I'm responsible for this." And the MST3K guys go, "In a way."
Right. This is what I'm saying. If the scientist isn't evil, at any rate, science itself is evil.
Right. Right.
And Mr. Spock really played a significant role in turning that around.
Fair enough. Well, listen, we are out of time, but I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back again soon to talk about more of life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. Thank you so much, Deacon Stephen Gardonis, for being on the show today.
Thank you, Mark.
All right. Bye-bye.